You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 3rd, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dorothy A. Brown, Asa Griggs Candler, professor of at the Emory University School of Law, on the whiteness of wealth, how the tax system impoverishes Black Americans, and how we can fix it. Also on the program today, more revelations of the Trump administration spying on journalists. And after Joe Biden meets Shelley Capito, the endgame seems near on the infrastructure bill. Andrew Cuomo reveals that taxpayers, New York State taxpayers, are paying for his defense and all the investigations he is facing. Israeli opposition leaders officially claim they can form a government. Bibi on the way out. Feds are investigating whether Matt Gaetz obstructed justice. And a new report: stimulus checks substantially reduced hardship in this country. Imagine that. Arizona getting blowback for using Zyklon B, famous for being used in the Holocaust, to execute its prisoners. U.S. appeal court leaves the CDC eviction moratorium in place. White House may send states vaccines abroad before they expire, which seems like a no-brainer. And lastly, the sad story of the end of Donald Trump's blogging career. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you may have noticed the smooth ramp down on the intro of that music, because today, for the first day in well over a year, we are all back in the office. We're not going to be doing this. This is not going to happen again for another couple of days and this and that, but we are slowly working our way in. Now, of course, Emma Viglin, who is here today, you have been in the office you and I have been in the office together for months now.
Yes, since
I
started.
But with that said, I'm still getting used to the idea of like not looking at you through a blurry
shower curtain. Yeah, well, I'm kind of bummed that...
We should be explicit about this. I had plastic tarp across the here.
Yes.
Shower curtains.
Rigged from, this pole over here. And I'm kind of sad that Matt and Brendan didn't get to see it in all its glory.
I know it. I did take some pictures for these guys, so they will be able to check it out. Over the coming weeks, our production is going to be upgraded slightly. Just slightly. Mm-hmm. Nothing too dramatic, but it is exciting. And I imagine, to some extent, this type of dynamic is happening across the country at this point. People are coming in, seeing people they hadn't seen for, over a year. And I have to admit that there didn't seem to be a lot of, celebration or jubilation when I came into the office today. So.
Well, I mean, you were enthusiastic.
I was enthusiastic, and everybody was just like, ugh. Don't like the light bulbs you're using in here.
We don't like to perform for you, to
yeah.
be honest.
Well, I mean, I wasn't looking for a performance. I just thought there might be some excitement, but no, not really.
The light bulbs were bad.
Yeah. All that said, thanks for joining us today. We have a great interview that I did pre-recorded with Dorothy Brown. Fascinating. This is we've heard a lot about the concept of there is no you know, we hear this from the right all the time. There is no more systemic racism in this country. And while there is not the level of institutional racism that we had, not like literally statutory racism that we had in this country, there is a tremendous amount of systemic racism that still exists in this country.
Sounds like some critical race theory.
Yes, and we may get to that clip after all. But first, let's start with this clip. Here is Kristen Sinema basically saying she doesn't want to take any hard votes.
Well, as folks in Arizona know, I've long been a supporter of the filibuster because it is a tool that protects the democracy of our nation. Rather than allowing our country to ricochet wildly every 2 to 4 years back and forth between policies, the idea of the filibuster was created by those who came before us, the United States Senate, to create comity and to encourage senators to find bipartisanship and work together. And while there are some who don't believe that bipartisanship is possible, I think that I'm a daily example that bipartisanship is possible. Not just this trip today and tomorrow that John and I are doing, but the work that John and I and many other of my colleagues in both parties do on a regular basis. So to those who say we must make a choice between the filibuster and X, I say this is a false choice. The reality is that when you have a system that's not working effectively, and I would think that most would agree that the Senate's not a particularly well-oiled machine, right? The way to fix that is to change your behavior, not to eliminate the rules or change the rules, but to change your behavior. So I'm going to continue to go to work every day, aggressively seeking bipartisanship in a cheerful and happy warrior way, as I always do, and showing that when we work together, we can get things done.
A lot of folks say that the filibuster is a relic of the Jim Crow era. And my sense is you don't support those things from the Jim Crow era, so why would you support the filibuster?
Well, the filibuster was not created as a tool to accomplish one thing or another. It was created as a tool to bring together members of different parties to find compromise and coalition. And when you think about our founding fathers, when they created the Senate with 2 senators from every state, regardless of population size, with elections staggered every, 6 years so that only a third of the body is up for election each cycle, it was designed to be a place where you cooled the passions of the House, where you work together to find that compromise, and importantly, where you protect the rights of the minority from the majority, regardless of which party is in the majority at the time.
This is...
Cooled the passions of the House is a really interesting way to say that you don't support the people's choice or the actual democracy.
First off, let's just go through the list here. The Founding Fathers did create the Senate. Incidentally, they also created it in such a way that you weren't allowed to elect it, the Senate, that they were appointed by the states. But they specifically did not create the filibuster. Incidentally, she is standing next to John Cornyn talking about the possibility of bipartisanship. John Cornyn voted against the literally bipartisan January 6th commission that had every single thing that the leader in their Republican leader in the House asked for. Every single thing. The idea that it protects us from allowing, things to ricochet is absurd. It's simply absurd. This is and the idea that when a system's not working, what you need to do is change your behavior really has a misunderstanding of the concept of systems. If the system is not working, the issue is the system, not the people in it. And a system has to be built in such a way that understands what's happening with the people.
The system changes the behavior, look, not the other way around.
The bottom line is Kristen Sinema is afraid to take difficult votes. She is afraid to vote against the infrastructure bill. She's afraid to vote against S1, the voting protection bills. She's afraid to vote against the PRO Act. She's afraid to vote against all these things, and she's afraid to vote for them. So she is just being utterly and simply cowardly, And that should be the line of attacks that people in Arizona take. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dorothy Brown. Folks, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. As you know, a lot of therapists right now, particularly, have very long wait lists. It can take weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. You know, COVID, obviously incredibly stressful. And I think people underestimate how stressful, like, sort of the post-pandemic era is. I'm finding that some people are freaking out more during this period than actually during the pandemic, because people just don't, it's hard to readjust to some type of, like, normalcy and to sort of, like, reestablish it. Regardless, there's never a bad time to see a therapist. And the beauty of BetterHelp is that once it connects you with a therapist, if it doesn't work out, if it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time. You could do so for any reason for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists who have specialties that may not be available in your area. So BetterHelp works for everyone and every type of problem that you might be dealing with. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you would find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp. And they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. We will put the link URL in the video description. If you're watching YouTube, we will do so in the podcast if you're listening. Check it out. Never a bad time to get therapy. Also, don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajoritireport.com. And now a pre-tape I did with Dorothy A. Brown, Asa Griggs Candler Professor at Emory University Law School. The book, The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report with me on the Zoom, as it were. Professor Dorothy Brown. She is a professor of law at Emory University and author of The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was just saying this before we started to record that this is so impressive and enlightening, I think. Particularly, we're in an era where there has been as the more I think that people begin to become aware of our history of Reconstruction, of the assaults on Black success, yes, frankly, that took place during Reconstruction, and then the subsequent institutional and governmental roadblocks that were put up to for Black people to develop wealth in this country, I think there's a greater awareness of it. And to the point now where we hear, well, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe, you know, the subtext of this is that people are talking about reparations in a more serious manner. We hear, well, there is no more systematic racism, right, in our country. And frankly, I have been guilty of saying, well, there is systematic racism, but there isn't necessarily the same level of institutional or governmental racism, but there is. And your book makes that quite clear. And, you know, put aside sort of the intent, although that's debatable, right, but even if we stipulate there is no intent, our government, in the way that it deals, and I'm not talking about policing here because I think there's another story there too, specifically the tax code.
Yes.
And Tell the story of how you came to sort of like be aware of this, because I found this sort of revelatory, and it is a it tells so much about the tax code, about the development of Black wealth in this country, but it also tells a lot about what you can do with statistics and statistics that you do not pursue. But start with your sort of, I guess, origin story.
Yeah, so my origin story is I grew up in the South Bronx. I dealt with racism, and I didn't want a job that forced me to deal with the substance of racism on my job. So I went into tax law because I thought tax law had absolutely nothing to do with race, as I like to say. The only color that was relevant was green. So I go into tax law and I'm doing my parents' tax returns like any good daughter, right, who has an LLM in tax. I do my parents' tax returns and I'm doing my returns and their returns and something's not adding up. I know what I'm doing. I'm doing everything right, but I should be paying a lot more in taxes than my parents because I by myself am making as much money as my parents combined. But that's not how it's working out. And I cannot figure it out. But of course, I have a job. So I finish the tax returns. I'm puzzled, but I go on to my daily routine. Next April 15th, I come through the same roadblock. What is going on? It isn't until I become an academic and actually have time to step back and think that I start to put the pieces of the puzzle together. But it's not until I read an article written by a then Duke law professor who was a mentor, who wrote an article that said, if you're a Black law professor, you should write about how systemic racism impacts the area of law you teach. So I thought this would be an interesting article. I teach tax law. I assumed it had absolutely nothing to do with me, but this professor always made me think. So I read the article and a couple pages from the end, it says, how do you know there isn't a race and tax problem if you don't look? And I went, what? Race and tax? So I picked up the phone, I called him, I said, I don't know what I'm gonna do, but I'm gonna do something. No sooner did I say that than I discovered the IRS doesn't publish statistics by race. So I can just stop there. It never occurred to me to think about the IRS publishing statistics by race, but it's really hard to write about racially disparate impact of tax policy when the IRS doesn't publish right. statistics by race. All and these other government agencies do, but not the IRS.
That's fascinating. How, I mean, I don't want to go too far down that without getting into the to the meat of the book, but let's do. What, like, do you think that was a mistake? Or Or was it just like, you know, there's a bunch of people there at the IRS who were like you were until you saw this essay and were like, what possible relevance would that have? What the race is to do racial breakdowns of how much, what the effective tax rate is, what the actual tax rate is, et cetera, et cetera.
So I think it was a conscious choice on the part of the Treasury and the IRS to not publish statistics by race. And the reason I say that is there's research that shows there were decisions made to publish statistics by gender or age, but not by race. So I think it was conscious. I think part of the reason why it was done was, well, if we don't have it, then you can't accuse us of discriminating on the basis of race. And in fact, several, like over 10 years ago, maybe even further back, I was on a panel talking about my race and tax work. And there was a person from the IRS there who said, I don't want to know. We don't want to know. It's really good that we don't have this information. So there's this idea that if you don't see it, it can't be discriminatory, when really my research shows is just because you don't see it doesn't mean it isn't operating in a discriminatory manner.
All right. And we're going to go through these things. Let me just say that the best analogy I can do relative to the work that you have done here, without it being too much of a spoiler alert, but I think you've made it clear, is, you know, for me personally, people in the audience have gone through this too, is sort of the understanding of the racial component of Social Security, that when, there was no explicit thing like, we're not going to have Black people participate in Social Security. But there is a proxy, and that proxy is we're going to not include certain jobs
right.
that just happen to be dominated or you know, widely populated by Black people. And,
right.
And that sort of feels like the same dynamic that's going on here. You look at this, if you don't see the outcomes divvied up through race, then it wouldn't necessarily occur to you because you don't see that proxy. So let's start with your parents. Like,
yes.
Why? Okay, so you have this mystery. Parents who combined make what you
yes.
make end up paying more in taxes. It's always that, like, if you're married, then
you get
actually
tax
save
cut.
In taxes.
Right. Well, you do if you're a certain type of married couple. If you are a married couple where one spouse works in the paid labor market and the other spouse is a stay-at-home spouse, when that couple gets married, they get a tax cut. And that's how the joint return was designed, to give single wage earner householders a tax cut. What my research shows, looking at Census Bureau data, is white married couples are more likely to be in single wage earner households, but not Black married couples. Black married couples are likely to be like my parents. My mother was a nurse. My father was a plumber. They made roughly equal amounts. That household doesn't get a tax cut. And worse, for several decades, that household paid higher taxes when they got married.
And this came out of what? There's a court case back in 1930. Tell us about that court case.
Yes. So it was Henry and Charlotte Seaborn were one of the few white Americans back in the late 1920s paying taxes. Because back then, our progressive tax system worked so that only the richest Americans pay taxes. But rich Americans don't like paying taxes. So the Seaborns thought of a way so that they could pay less taxes. And the way they did it was he worked and he had income and he tried to shift half of his income to his wife so that the last dollar of his income and her income would be taxed at a lower marginal tax rate than if he was taxed on 100% of it. Well, that wasn't what the tax law allowed. The tax law basically required us to file as individuals. But the Seaborns go rogue with the help of their tax advisors and file returns where half of his income is on his return and half is on hers. The IRS says, you can't do that. They go to court. It goes all the way up to the Supreme Court and the Seaborns win. And they win because they're in a community property state where legally his spouse has a right to half of his income. So the Supreme Court says if you're in a community property state, you can split your income. But if you're not in a community property state, you cannot. So we had a situation where dependent on where rich people lived would determine whether they could get a tax cut from using this technique. Well, Congress came to the rescue in 1948 with the joint return, which basically said it didn't matter what state you lived in, you could have your income split among your stay-at-home spouse and therefore cut your taxes.
So just to be clear on what that means, if the threshold for let's say, I mean, I guess in 48, maybe in the 50s, it would have been about 90% if I'm making over like $450,000.
Taxes were very high. Yes.
And so if I have the ability to say, okay, I'm making $460,000 or I'm making, let's say, $500,000. I don't want that $50,000 to be taxed at a 90% marginal rate. So I'm going to attribute $250,000 to me and $250,000 to Mrs.
Sam
Singer, is what I would have called her at the time. And therefore, I'm not subjected to that 90% tax rate. So, okay, so I get that part and I get then and Congress makes that fix. But why does that implicate your parents?
So first of all, in 1948, we know from research that white couples were way more likely to be in single wage earner households than Black couples, even in 1948. So in 1948, if anybody was paying attention, and nobody was, think about 1948. It was before Brown v. Board. of it. It was before Civil Rights Act. People were not thinking about black equality, right? So, but even in 1948, we knew married black couples would not be getting the tax cuts the way married white couples were. But who was also upset that the Henry Seaborns of the world got a tax cut? The single Henrys of the world. So let's look at single Henry who makes $100,000 and married Henry who makes $100,000. Married Henry pays less in taxes because he has a married filing jointly rate schedule that gives him a tax cut. Well, single Henry was not happy, and single Henry lobbied Congress. So in 1969, they changed the code once more, whereby single Henry paid higher taxes, but not significantly higher, which meant the marriage bonus was decreased for the Seaborns. The singles penalty was decreased for the single Henrys, but married couples with dual equal earning wage earners paid higher taxes. That was the outcome of the rate schedule change in 1969. So from that point on, people like my parents, when they got married, they paid higher taxes.
And so, and of course, the reason why, I mean, there are probably many reasons why you have a situation where that dynamic exists, where white people have a higher propensity to have a single breadwinner or a breadwinner who is significantly more winning more bread than the other, because first off, there's not the ceiling that existed for black people and probably still exists, frankly, in terms of how much money. There's just a lot more white people have the opportunity to make a lot more money than a black and at that time, male head of household. And so both members of that couple would have to work because neither one of them has the earning potential, particularly then, but I would argue probably now as well, in the same way, to make, you know, extraordinary sums of money that you'd want to dish off to your spouse. All right. So so are there other penalties within the context of marriage? Because I want to go through some of the other sort of like silos in which the tax code punishes, wittingly or unwittingly, sort of irrelevant in terms of the implications. Black people. So is that it for marriage?
I would say yes, but I will just point out one thing. Over time, more white couples were facing the marriage penalty. So I believe the reason why the Trump tax cuts minimized the marriage penalty was because more and more married white couples were facing it.
Oh, that's fascinating. And how does that, when you say it, it makes total sense to me that that would be the case. But I mean, how do you see that manifest? Like, does that just simply like, are people just sort of looking at like, okay, Here's our constituency. How can we give them tax relief? And it just so happens, I mean, when the Republicans look at their constituency, they don't have to say like, should we advantage white people or black people? They're looking at their constituency. Right. And so it's like, well, of course it's going to advantage white people because 93% of our voters are white people.
Right. Right. So, you know, research shows we still have a majority of white married couples getting the marriage bonus, but it's a significant minority of married white couples who are paying the penalty. So there are more and more white couples paying the penalty, which is why I believe you saw the Trump tax cuts. But let me just say, for low-income workers who are eligible for the earned income tax credit, there was no marriage penalty relief in the Trump tax cuts. None. So at the very high end, at the very low end, there was no marriage penalty relief.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move on to education.
Yes.
Because there's another dynamic here. Tell us about that.
So in education, it's about how people pay for college. And how people pay for college in the black community is very different than in the white community. In the white community, you may have grandma or parent who pays for your college, which leads, and the same is not true in the Black community, which leads to Black college graduates leaving with more student debt. And the only tax relief we give for student debt is up to $2,500 of interest, which I did the math, doesn't allow Black college graduates to deduct all their interest in the early years because their debt is too great.
Wow.
So we see that, you know, everybody says, or people think, oh, college is this great equalizer. Well, no, it isn't, because Black Americans experience college very different than their white peers. For the first, 60% of Black students who start college don't graduate. So most people leave college with debt, but no ability to get a better paying job to amortize that debt. And then over time, the debt grows, either because of income-based repayment, either because Black students are more likely to go to graduate school when we graduate. So we've got more debt that we are stacking on. And research shows even wealthy Black parents cannot protect their students from debt the way wealthy white parents can.
So there's a couple of things. So essentially, college is more expensive for Black people. It's basically
exactly.
Just like that's it. I would imagine the incidence of graduate degrees is higher because Black people are more conscious of the headwinds that they're facing when they go into the career path. And so they feel that they need to have more, bona fides to deal in, which I would imagine is also the case.
Absolutely.
And we should also say that the 529.
Yes.
Would also have the same effect, but on the front side, correct?
Yes. And you see more white Americans, I mean, an overwhelmingly amount of white Americans who have or those who have 529s, and very few Black Americans can afford to put money away. Why? Because we're paying extra taxes. Why? Because we're sending home money to parents and or siblings because of Jim Crow, because there's no safety net, because the wealth disparities prevent Black Americans from building wealth, much less handing it down. So you take two Black workers with the same income level, that's like suspend disbelief and, you know, work with me on this hypo.
Right.
The Black worker has more demands on their dollars than the white worker, which is sending money to parents. Whereas research shows white college graduates are more likely to get money from their parents and grandparents and use it for further wealth building.
And we should say that, I mean, let's talk about home ownership. And while we're there, we should say that that is where you see a tremendous, you know, and if you expand it to just property in general, that's where you see really an extensive history of government and institutional racism that essentially it's the primary builder of intergenerational wealth.
Yes.
Home
yes.
ownership and property. And so that's the deficit that requires that creates more demand on those dollars of a Black worker contemporarily. But let's talk about home ownership in terms of like from a tax standpoint.
Right.
And maybe we can touch on some of those other factors that have inhibited. Because it all, I mean, it's like
a web, right?
Well, it's a web, and it also there's a linear quality to this in that, like, you know, people talk about the wonders of APR, right? Of interest rate that accrues,
right.
But there's a reverse impact too,
right.
And that's sort of what Black people have been caught up in since. Well, I mean, I guess including slavery, but,
yes.
But certainly since Reconstruction.
So with respect to home ownership, we allow a tax break if you sell your home for a gain. If you're married, up to $500,000 of your gain is tax-free. If you're single, $250,000. If you sell your home at a loss, no tax deduction. Well, research shows the most gain is found in homogeneous white neighborhoods where most white homeowners live. Where are Black Americans most likely to live? Black homeowners are most likely to live in racially diverse or all Black neighborhoods. So if we sell for a gain, it's significantly less than if we were to buy in an all white neighborhood. And Black homeowners are most likely to sell for a non-deductible loss. So homeownership, which is valued by most homeowners, right? That's how the market works. And most homeowners are white. They don't want to live around too many Black neighbors, which means only one or two Black Americans can buy into a neighborhood in a all-white neighborhood and get the wealth out of it that their white neighbors do. But it comes with, you know, the possibility of your neighbors calling the cops on you. It comes with the possibility of, if you have children in an all-white school district, you're going to have to fight with the teachers and principals who are going to racially profile your child. So it could be a good financial investment, but there's going to be a hassle or two that you're going to have to deal with. On the other hand, if you buy in a racially diverse or all Black neighborhood, you're going to see lots of people who look like you. You don't have to worry about your neighbors calling the cops. They know who you are, but you won't get out of your home what you would if you lived around more white Americans. So the tax subsidies in the 21st century are further subsidizing this racist housing market, right? You talked about the history, FHA loans, et cetera, that were barred to Black Americans. But here we have tax subsidies still supporting a racist housing market.
And I guess we should also say that, like, that you get it on the capital gains tax, that you're not actually making that money. And so you don't get that benefit of that free money, that, you know, $250,000 right. or $500,000 tax free. I mean, yeah.
that's a lot,
you know, depending on where we end up with the capital gains tax. I mean, we're looking at, you know, $100,000 or more.
Yes, absolutely.
That you save. And then you just plow that into your next house and the cycle continues. And then,
right.
you know, and we should also say that, and I think you touched on this, but the propensity of white people to own houses because their parents sold their house that they were able to get a loan for at a massive, benefit. And maybe they gave some money to their kids, or the kids have it, or there's not the same ceiling in terms of getting jobs.
Grandma dies and they inherit the house. Yep.
And so, there's also the interest. There's the mortgage interest deduction.
Yes.
And I want to get to that because that's an issue, in terms of the SALT taxes. But generically speaking, if I'm paying $2,000 in a mortgage versus $2,000 in rent,
yes,
I'm
one
actually,
of those. Yes,
I'm actually paying closer to, like, well, it depends on what my income is, but I could be paying really $1,400 in rent or $1,800 in rent, because I'm getting to deduct the interest on this loan.
That's right. That's right. So rent is not deductible. The majority of Blacks are renters. Mortgage interest is deductible. The majority of white Americans are homeowners. But I will say, after the 2017 Tax Act, with the significant increase in the standard deduction, only about 1 in 10 Americans anymore itemized, period. It used to be a third. Now we're down to 1 in 10.
Okay. And so, so I should say, like, you know, for years I was saying, like, you know, our system benefits homeowners in a big way because of that mortgage interest deduction. And what I could have easily also said it during that time was it benefits white people.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the point of that. Well, let's talk about children as well. And there may be a different dynamic now a little bit with,
The expanded
child COVID
care.
Relief.
Yes.
But we don't know if that's going to be permanent. So let's talk about what it was 2 years ago.
Yes. So, you know, for decades, we have had a child tax credit that treated children differently if your parents were poor. If your parents were eligible for the earned income tax credit, that household could not get a full child tax credit. And that's the way the law was designed. So with the Biden administration, pushing for the expanded child tax credit such that every earned income tax credit household can now get the child tax credit. That's a huge move forward. It's a really big deal. It's temporary. I expect to see the Biden administration push for that to be permanent. And it's kind of miraculous, right? Because it was done,
right,
part of COVID, no argument. It was just done.
Very easy peasy.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about, and I just want to touch on one more silo before we talk about some of the proposals that are on the table right now. Everything around death and inheritance, the estate tax.
Yes.
I mentioned, you know, I once had an interesting exchange with Donahue Peebles, who apparently is one of the richest black men in the country, according to Forbes. I was on a panel with him. I had no idea who he was. We were talking about the repeal of the inheritance tax.
Right.
And the estate tax. And we got into an argument about it. And he said there's a reason why the Congressional Black Caucus supports it. It is to build black intergenerational wealth. And I was like, I feel like there's other ways of doing that, except for,
right,
just like your black intergenerational,
right,
wealth.
Exactly.
But talk how that dynamic also favors, and I think it's quite obvious on some level from what you've said at this point, you know, with this rubric, but explain.
Yes. So first of all, on the income tax side, you can give income to anyone and they get it tax-free. So the payment that grandparent may pay, give their grandchild for college or anything else, gifts and inheritances are tax-free on the income tax side. On the estate and gift tax side, now we've got like $23 million you can give without having to pay any taxes, which basically is almost everybody, but maybe 400 people, right? So
right. It's
a ridiculously high amount, but it's how intergenerational wealth is transferred and how tax law enables the white transmission of wealth. The exclusion or the ability to give or receive gifts tax-free dates back to 1913. So let's talk, right? 1913, who had wealth? We know who had wealth.
Right.
It wasn't people who looked like my ancestors, right? It was white people. So the provision was designed for white people to transfer wealth tax-free. And the estate tax now allows you to do it at death as well. So it's a double whammy. It's designed to help keep white wealth in the family, as it were. And I agree with your take that, yeah, there may be a generation of black wealthy folks coming up, but they are the exception. We should not be making tax policy for a handful of black people. We should be making tax policy for the majority of black people.
Right, exactly. Let's tax the dollar that you give to your kids upon your death and use that money to, if we want to provide, you know, tax cuts
right,
to people, do it, you know, to renters get, you
that's
know,
right.
There's easier ways of doing that. Well, not just easier. I mean,
fairer. I'll say
ways.
It.
Exactly. I was going to say, like, it's pretty easy for that guy.
Right.
So, okay. So what, I guess the first thing, and let's talk about some of these solutions, then we can maybe just assess one or two proposals that are out there right now. The first thing that we should do to fix this is to start recording racial data as a way, right? Because
yes,
then we can't hide in the way
yes,
that guy on the panel wanted to hide.
Yes, exactly. Step one, we need the publication of data by race, and President Biden's executive order that he signed, his first executive order, talked about the disaggregation of data by race across government agencies. So there is a framework for this, but the problem is there is no one I see at Treasury who's competent to carry this out. So we've got the president at a high level saying, I want this done, but the appointees at Treasury have never written about race and tax. They are, in my opinion, clueless. So I am cautiously pessimistic about the ability of the administration to get it done, but there is a framework at least.
But how hard would that be at least to collect the data, right? Like, I mean, don't you just have to put on the form your race?
I would say we don't want it on the form because that could subject people to audits. That could subject people to other bad activity. We have the IRS has a statistics of income division, which is the unit that publishes all this data to begin with. They publish data by gender. They publish data by age. They need to be tasked with publishing the data by race, period, full stop. Figure it out. It's not complicated. Other people have done it. Just do it.
So there's a division at IRS that is sequestered from the enforcement division.
Yes.
And you would have them do it.
Yes.
And so and they would figure it out in the same way that they figure out gender, which isn't necessarily on the IRS.
Thank you.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify.
No, you're brilliant. That's exactly right. They do gender. It's like there's nothing on the form about age. They do age. So they figure it out when they want to figure it out. This is, you know, it just needs to be a directive, to be honest with you.
Interesting. Okay. And so, and then of course, like what would you do for the tax system? How would you change? Would it be wholesale changes to the tax system, or would there be like surgical changes to the tax system?
So I have two answers. If you were asking me if I was in charge, what would I do? It would be wholesale. I would get rid of the exclusions, the deductions, and the loopholes. I would tax income the same, whether it's from capital gains or whether it was from wages. I would only allow a deduction for what I call a living allowance, which was how much people need to live in their particular area. Any amount over that, you pay taxes at a progressive rate structure. Any amount less, the government gives you a check. It's like an expanded earned income tax credit. And then I would have a wealth credit where I would give a tax break to any American in a household with below median wealth. That is going to disproportionately benefit Black Americans, but not exclusively. So that's like my big picture fix. But if we're talking
Would you have a flip side on that too, on the wealth tax, a tax
credit? In my ideal tax system, I didn't go that far, but there's nothing wrong with a wealth tax at the high end.
Okay.
I think the wealth credit for the low end would have more of an impact right across the board. So that's why I went that way. Now, if we were doing one-offs, I would say tax income from stock the same way it's income from wages. So President Biden has a proposal, if you have more than $1 million, which is going to impact 0.3% of American taxpayers. It's like, okay. So I'm not impressed with the $1 million cutoff.
Right.
When he has a $400,000 cutoff for all these other individual tax policies. So I think the $1 million cutoff, I'm sure wasn't an accident, but I would want to see it significantly lowered.
Just to be clear, the $400,000 deals with income from working as opposed to the income that you get from having money that you parked somewhere.
That's right.
And put a bet down, basically.
Right. So a lot of the other individual tax proposals from President Biden, there's a cutoff. If you make $400,000 or less, you're not going to have to pay higher taxes. If you earn more than $400,000, your taxes will go up. So my argument is, well, then let's have that rule for capital gains. If your income is more than $400,000, you should pay the same rate of tax on your wage income as your capital gains income. But President Biden says over $1 million.
All right, fair enough. And so let's talk about, so those are the key things that you would do. And to a certain extent, right, that's your, this is a back of the envelope thing because we don't have the data.
That's right.
To assess.
That's right.
Like where this is going to fall. So you're just, this is basically like.
Based on my 25 years experience studying this, loopholes and exclusions benefit white Americans disproportionately.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, broadly speaking, that should be somewhat obvious because, it's the same dynamic as like a 529.
Right.
Presumably it's race neutral, but if the only people who have, or the vast majority of people who have extra income to set aside to accrue with profits are white, then it is, you're basically saying like it's a race, and
that's right.
I'm just randomly picking who's going to be carrying a, you know, 200 pound anvil. Right. And it just all happens that it's, you know,
it's all happened to be black but people. You know, yeah.
Right. But this is a race neutral, decision-making thing. Right. So, all right. So let's talk about, the salt, tax. I mean, this is just, it's stunning to me because we see such a political determination, like the grit that we want for every progressive policy that the Democrats to fight for, but they're focused on the salt taxes. And I mean, explain to us what the salt is, because
right.
When I first heard this, I was like, oh, well, that's actually bad because it's going to discourage, you know, blue states from raising taxes. But then when you realize who's paying it, it's like, no.
Right. So it's the state and local taxes. If you itemize deductions, this only works if you itemize deductions. If you itemize deductions, you can get a deduction for your state income taxes, state and local income taxes. Well, what the Trump tax cuts did was say, or for your real property taxes and your state and local taxes, you're limited to only deducting $10,000. If you pay more than that, and if you live in a state like New York or California where the state taxes are high, you're going to pay more than that. You are denied a deduction in the excess of $10,000. So now the Democrats have taken over the House and the Senate, and they're talking about removing the cap, which means now everybody can take the deduction for state and local taxes. The problem is, remember I said, based on the Trump tax cuts, only 1 in 10 Americans are itemizing? Yeah. The people who are itemizing are the highest income Americans. So this 10% are our highest income taxpayers. So removing the cap is going to benefit them. That's not something I would want to argue for. It's like, why aren't the Dems putting their energy elsewhere? I testified like a week ago. Well, because their constituents want them, right? The constituents in New York and the constituents elsewhere.
The constituents with money, right?
I mean, it's only exactly.
It's the top 80% of the benefits go to something like the top 1%, or 50% go to the top 1%.
It's a ridiculous. They call it an upside down subsidy. It is a ridiculous percentage, like almost all of it that goes to the highest income Americans. And it's hard to make a push that you want tax reform that's fairer for America and argue for the cap to be removed, right? I think part of it is, I don't think they want to say like Trump had a good idea, right? You know, it was like there's a couple things that the 2017 Tax Act did that was like good. One of them was significantly increasing the standard deduction. That was long overdue, right? That was one of the really good things. That's why we only have like 10% of Americans itemizing, which I say is the time to get rid of all the rest of the itemized deductions, because only 1 in 10 Americans, and they're the highest income Americans, does it matter?
And so give me a sense of, like, I'm just curious, like, okay, so can you put some numbers on here, like, from the deduction? Like, I'm bad when it comes to these type of things. Like, if I have a house and it's $1 million house, and I get taxes, I live in Westchester, and real estate taxes are really high. Let's say they're, I don't know, $25,000 a year or something.
Yes. Okay. And there's a state income tax and there's a city income tax. If you're in New York, you can only deduct 10,000 of that. So you are leaving a lot of money on the table with
but
that.
But what does that mean? I mean, like, walk me through that. So, like, if there's, I'm paying $25,000 tax there, and I'm paying a state income tax of, I don't know, it depends on what my income, but let's just say another,
$15,000. Okay.
So, okay.
And local.
And local.
right?
And so, like,
let's
another
say seven.
Seven. Okay.
Okay.
So we're talking like I'm $50,000 worth of tax.
Yes, close to $50,000, and you could only deduct 10.
And so I can deduct 10, and so I still get. I'm responsible for paying taxes on $40,000 of that.
Right.
And my tax bill on that $40,000 is going to be, I don't know, let's just say my you know, the federal tax rate, like 30% or something.
Yeah.
Because I'm a super high earner. I mean, so we're talking there for these small percentage of people in that instance, we're talking about, I don't know, like I'm going to be paying $12,000,
right.
$14,000 extra. Like,
right.
Seriously?
I know.
You know, we have better place. To, like, what am I going to do with that $14,000 anyways? Like, I have my horse ranch in Westchester. Like, yeah. What am I going to do with that $12,000?
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand.
I don't
that
either.
Dynamic,
let's put it this way. They're not sympathetic taxpayers. That's what I talk about in class. These people are not sympathetic taxpayers.
Right. And what's amazing is how motivated I am as a member of the New York delegation, aside from AOC and maybe one others.
Right.
Like, I've got
to
get
done.
That. I've got to yes. get that $14,000 going to fundamentally change their life when that's that tax savings in and of itself is half the median income of people. Like, well, how much they make, never mind what they pay in taxes.
Right. Agreed. It's, you know, I don't know. I don't see it happening. We'll see, but I don't see it happening. I see there's a lot of talk, but I, you know, let's put it this way. Removing the cap would give an argument to the Republicans about fairness. And that's I don't think that's what the Democrats want to be. But I'm not a politician, so what do I know?
Is there any other proposals that are floating around out there that you think are particularly good or bad?
I think raising the corporate tax rate is good. Because lowering it to 21%, which is what happened with the Trump tax cuts, was ridiculously low. I also think what they're trying to do in terms of getting a minimum international tax is critical. So, you know, I think what's being done on the corporate side, especially with the international, I like that a lot.
This is an initiative by Janet Yellen to get like almost a Paris Accords for a minimum tax, so you don't have capital flight for people trying to escape minimum taxes.
Yes.
I would imagine people are going to want to do that, although it's also easy for me to imagine there's like one tiny country that's going to say, like, we're going to be the one-stop shop. We're going to be the one with all the P.O. boxes.
Right. And there are levers that the United States has to impose costs. So they'll say it, but they probably won't do it.
The book is The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans. Professor Dorothy Brown, thank you so much for your time today. Really fascinating, very enlightening, and very explicit. And so for folks who want to know how to respond to the idea of whether there is still systemic racism, there's literally 250 pages of examples in your book. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for us today. We will see you tomorrow. Is that not correct?
It's correct.
All right.
Good
we will
job.
See you on Friday.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us. And for those of you who are sticking around, no fun half today, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies. We're doing a tech day, so we're doing a tech day.
Well, I mean, it's all for the greater good because we're going to do a tech day so that we can be back in studio. And,
right.
No more Zoom issues. Well, still probably.
No, we're going to have a whole new suite of tech issues.
Oh, right.
That's the way we do it around here. And I don't know, the greater good, maybe narrow good.
Okay.
Better for the narrow good.
Yeah, I mean, it's good for you to tamper expectations, I guess.
Exactly. We got to manage expectations. But folks, we're going to be back tomorrow with an amazing show. We'll see you then.